world for some time, but then after a while, all your toys will be taken away from you. So only devotional service is actually auspicious because it's eternal. It doesn't get taken away from you, it increases. Now, on the stage of Bhava Bhakti, Moksha Lagu Krit, that there are many quotes how devotional service is millions of times more satisfying than if one drop in the ocean of sense gratification is multiplied, or a million, or of liberation. Actually, there's a whole, I forget what scriptures say. It says that the happiness on the earth planet, the demigods in the next higher realm, it's not Indra Loka yet. I think it goes from the earthly people to the Charanas, to the Gandharvas, and finally to the Devas, and then above the Devas is Mahaloka, the residence of Mahaloka. Above Mahaloka are the four planets known as Tapaloka, Janaloka, Siddhaloka, and then Brahmaloka. So it keeps on multiplying 100 times the happiness. And then if you multiply the happiness in Brahmaloka 100 times, then it becomes the happiness in Siddhaloka, the Siddhaloka or the Brahmanda. Brahman effulgence. And then if you multiply that 1,000,000 times, it doesn't equal to 1 atomic fraction of a drop in the ocean of devotional service attained at the stage of bhava. So obviously if you're at that stage, you're going to not think very much about liberation. But I personally can't even imagine what they're talking about. It sounds good though. And even we can understand, even sometimes we may get some drop of mercy coming from Krishna or from the deities, or but still if it was actually a real drop, then we wouldn't be in the material world anymore. We'd be completely transcendental. So even we think, wow, that was an amazing experience, I can't believe it, I'm practically pure devotee, we should probably just calm down a little bit, realize that we still got a long way to go. Even Brahma, he was in Brahmaloka, he was hearing the Gandharvas singing about Krishna's glories, completely in ecstasy. And afterwards, that's when, I forget the name, who came with Revati. So he's in ecstasy practically all the time, and he's still a conditioned soul, performing sadhana bhakti, at least generally Brahmas like that. So devotional service is really beyond our... I mean, of course, it's nice to get a little drop of mercy here and there. Otherwise, you know, it's difficult to go on all the time, but we shouldn't get too overwhelmed with the mercy we're getting. Think, wow, this is enough for 3 years, you know. Otherwise, if we get like that, it will take another 3 years before you can get another drop. But those little drops of mercy add up, and they inspire us, keep us going on. And then one day we'll understand what something like anartha nivritti means. And then after some time, getting a lot more mercy, inconceivably more mercy, we may arrive at the state of nishtha. And then beyond even anything we could even imagine in our wildest dreams, we come to the state of ruchi. And way after that, we can't even begin to even conceive of what asakti or bhava or and prema is unlimited. So here it's mentioned it's unattainable by our own efforts. Of course, it's not that, you know, Krishna is like some kind of torturer, you know. He holds the prasad, you know, the bliss over there, and the soul is jumping up, and Krishna goes... It's not obtainable by our efforts.
Krishna.
And then once in a while when you go, oh, this is too much, and he goes, all right. No, Krishna's not like that. But I guess we can imagine that it's so subtle. you know, just this idea that I'm doing, I'm practicing, to actually, I deserve, so I sacrifice so much. You know, as long as that's there, then the real feeling of surrender isn't there. Then we think, I did it, rather than, you know, I'm just completely dependent on Krishna. So Krishna reserves it. And he makes sure we don't think, well, I'm doing my sadhana, now I'm chanting, you know, I'm paying attention, you know, all right, Krishna, come and surrender. Then the whole mood of real devotion can't be there. That I'm love, just like Asheshava Padam Panistama. That you can trample me, you can leave me brokenhearted, but you're still my beloved. So unless that mood is developed, you know, it's not, I chant Hare Krishna, Krishna pops in into view. I stop chanting Hare Krishna, Krishna pops out of view. As if Krishna is just like, you know, a puppet that, you know, we bring out sometimes, put back into the box sometimes. No, Krishna has to reserve that, or else the actual mood of devotional service won't be there. Because ultimately, when Krishna does finally reveal himself to us, when we're actually completely Krishna, then Krishna actually becomes controlled by the devotee. Then it's too late. Then Krishna can't, you know. We can't be like Vrikasura. Lord Shiva gave him the benediction, and then suddenly the Vrikasura decides to use the benediction to crack everyone's heads on Lord Shiva. So Krishna has to make sure that when he actually, you know, we become Krishna conscious, we're actually qualified for it. Or else it won't be very good for us, and it won't be very good for the spiritual world either. Be the first soul to fall back. So the next one is, I guess those are the two qualities, moksha lagu krit and sudurlava, difficult to achieve, because it can't be obtained by our own efforts. And then sundarananda visheshatma, incalculably condensed bliss. So just the idea that there's no material world anymore. I mean, it's inconceivable. There's no, all we know is everyone's engaged in Krishna service except for me. And then the other one for Sri Krishna Karshani. So Baba Bhakti, Krishna appears temporarily but at the state of Krishna Karshani, then Krishna actually one enters into Krishna's pastimes. In other words, we're sitting here, we think we know who we are, but we haven't the faintest idea who we are. We have no idea who we are. We actually, each one of us, we have a completely different identity, completely different form, completely different, you know, life. But now we're living this dream, so at the state of Sri Krishna Karshani, when actually one is attracted to Krishna, then at that stage we enter into our real life, and our real life begins again. So that's a life of unlimited bliss, unlimited loving feelings towards everyone. Constantly increasing at every moment. Just unlimited rasa. So here we think, now I'm gaining something, now I lost something, so many things. But it's not even considered in the spiritual life. There's no loss, there's no gain, there's nothing but Krishna and loving Krishna and his devotees. So I think I'd stop there. Way beyond my realization. Any questions? Yeah.
I remember that I heard once that a spiritual master has to be situated at least on the platform of Nishtha. Is that correct? A bona fide spiritual master.
Well, correct. Bona fide spiritual master, the minimum qualification to be a bona fide spiritual master, because each one of us are actually supposed to be bona fide spiritual masters. It's not just because someone gives diksha, therefore he becomes a bona fide spiritual master. But even those who are giving shiksha, they're also acting as spiritual masters. Because the basic principle is that we're expecting when we preach to someone that they're going to listen. Otherwise, if we're not interested in people listening to us, there's plenty of trees to go to talk to. We're expecting that we're going to say something about, and people will listen. They're not only that are listening, but we expect them, if they didn't understand what we just said, that they'd ask us a question. And then they do something. So everyone's really expected to be the guru. I mean, if someone gives a bhakti program, it's not that the bhakti leader is thinking, well, I'm not really the guru here, you know, so it doesn't really matter what I say. They don't really have to follow me anyhow. You know, I tell them to, you know, eat with their right hand, but, you know, I'm not the guru, why should they do that? And the bhaktis are thinking, well, he's not the guru, why should I eat with my right hand? Left hand is just as good. So that's really, I mean, what's the difference? Diksha, as soon as we talk about diksha, diksha is just to fix the neophyte and following the shiksha. It has no other purpose. This idea that, you know, diksha is like some magic wand you pick up and you hit, you know, that touches the devotee and suddenly he's in the spiritual world because he got initiated. People may think like that, but I don't know. Maybe someone had that experience, but they're not around anymore to tell us. At least it wasn't my experience. You know, I'm confident that Prabhupada was a completely qualified devotee. You know, but when I got diksha, which was by mail, you know, it wasn't that when I, you know, got the beads back that suddenly I was in the spiritual world. So diksha is more or less to fix the neophyte and certain the shiksha. So everyone is acting shiksha. Everyone in this movement is giving shiksha. So what makes someone bona fide is that we're not giving our own shiksha. One day we don't say that Krishna is God, and the next day we think, well, he might be God, but, you know, there's some demigod you might have to look into too, because, you know, Shiva is pretty auspicious. So as long as we give the right, the same shiksha coming down in disciplic succession, then we're considered bona fide. So we may be on the Kanista Adhikari platform, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't preach. Now, a Madhyama Adhikari, generally he knows he's a Madhyama Adhikari. A Kanista Adhikari, he may imagine anything. Generally, many Kanista Adhikaris, they think they're at the stage of Uttama. Therefore, they may be completely convinced, you know, of the wrong thing. A Madhyama Adhikari, at least he has some, you know, basic theoretical knowledge. He may not always get the right thing, but when he may not always have the conclusive knowledge, but he has the basic structure. Therefore, he can be easily corrected by the Vaishnavas. He knows what, you know, his relation with Krishna. He's supposed to love Krishna. He can be, you know, corrected by the Vaishnavas. He knows his mission is to preach, and he knows he has to avoid the atheists. So he has the foundation to advance. So when you're preaching, there may be some allurements, not only for the Madhyama, for the Kanista. Anyone who's preaching, he'll get some allurements. So the Madhyama won't be so much affected by the allurements, but the Kanista can be. So the Kanista has to understand he's a Kanista. The Madhyama has to understand he's a Madhyama. Because if the Madhyama starts thinking he's an Uttama, which he usually won't because he has discrimination, but he has to understand things properly. He can't imitate an Uttama. And of course the Uttama, who's on the highest platform, there's no problem. Because Krishna is directing his activities. So he's not going to have any problems. And he has so much happiness, there's no attraction for anything else. Everything is perfectly arranged for his service. So the real problem is the Kanista, when he thinks he's an Uttama, or even he thinks he's a Madhya. That's when the problem comes about. But that's not only for the person giving diksha. Anyone. It's not the only people who give diksha fall down. Plenty of other people fall down too, without giving diksha, for the same reasons that the diksha guru may fall down, or have some difficulty. But still, generally, Prabhupada says, generally speaking, one shouldn't become a spiritual master unless he's meaning Prabhupada is specifically referring to Diksha Guru, unless he's an Uttama. Although we can see in Prabhupada's instructions that the minimum qualification that he recommended was more or less Madhyam, a high Madhyam, strict follower, Prabhupada said. Because ultimately we have to understand that we're not the preacher, that we're the instrument. Because that's the only way one can actually, that service, because one it has to be a service. One has to see that actually my disciples are actually my spiritual master. And they're teaching me because I'm the instrument, I'm simply repeating what my spiritual master told me. And therefore, when they're following the instructions, they're not my instructions, they're my spiritual master's instructions. And they're teaching me how to serve my spiritual master by following my spiritual master's instructions. So I'm learning from them how to serve my spiritual master. So it's not a very complicated thing, but one has to at least actually realize that all the time. Then there's no question of the relationship going wrong. But if one is thinking that they're my disciples, then immediately there's a problem, because nothing really belongs to us. Then one is immediately an illusion. So a Madhyama, at least he can discriminate. You know, when he's a Maya, think, well, these are my disciples. So he can understand I'm a Maya. But a Kanista, he can actually think, because he has less discrimination. He may not recognize that he's a Maya by thinking like that. But if the spiritual master, he can't say, well, there's no relationship. He can't say, well, I gave you initiation, but you're not mine, I have nothing to do with you. But that doesn't make sense either, because they don't belong to you, they belong to Krishna. And you're supposed to be the instrument, that's what the whole relationship was. Not that I gave you an initiation, you're free to do whatever you want. Then that's Maya too. So if you become aloof from your disciples, you know, then you misled them. And if you become attached to them, then you'll become bewildered and they'll become bewildered too. So it's a very subtle difference. And something that usually Kanista cannot really understand very well. Because of the subtle thing, you have to actually be in a platform where you're actually seeing your disciples as your teaching you through following your guru's instructions how to perform devotional service. Not only that, but all the devotees. And then you don't become the proprietor. You don't think yourself the proprietor. So Madhyam, even a Madhyam can have difficulty, but he'll theoretically understand it. Therefore he'll correct himself, or others can easily correct him. He won't go off the path. But Kanistas, it's very easy. But they can be corrected too. It's not an impossible thing, it's just a little difficult, that's all. What's that? Madhyam? Madhyam means middle. Middle. So Madhyam means they see four things. They see Krishna as the object of love. They see the devotees as the object of friendship. They see the innocent as object of mercy to bring them to Krishna consciousness. And they see the persons who are inimical as being to just ignore them or try to avoid their association. So that's Madhyam. Madhyam usually means the person has enough knowledge and experience that he's actually come to a platform of spiritual experience. He's more interested in a spiritual experience, spiritual elevation, than material benefit, even subtly. Although, because he's middle, it's not that he's completely enlightened or completely free from material existence. But he knows he wants more, he wants spiritual life. He's not attracted to material life. But still, he has something to work on before he actually comes to actual full spiritual life. Is that right?
Yes. I was thinking in terms of responsibility. How there are different levels of spiritual master, but still those who initiate, they more or less they take the responsibility.
Well, the real responsibility is to preach. So everyone has to show an example and preach. When we say preaching, we mean show the example. Acharya, Apani Acharya, bhakti, shikara, sabara. That's only one verse where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says that I will show by my personal example, and struck bhakti by my personal example. So our personal example and our preaching, that's the more than that, that's the responsibility. The spiritual master can't force anyone to do anything. Everything is actually ultimately or generally done voluntarily. So that's the responsibility, show the right example and preach. Now, of course, if one is actually directed by Krishna, you know, then one can do all kinds of, just like if one is on distributing books. Now, book distribution is something which is obvious, how much potency we have. Because if one is less potent, not only people won't stop, but they seem to be, they ignore you. And then if you're more potent, then people may stop, you may give them a book and there's a nice exchange. And if you're really potent, people who normally never even consider stopping suddenly are, you know, stopping right there, and they don't even know what they're doing. They're giving you a donation, taking the book, they can't even figure it out themselves what's happening. So that stage is not very common. But it's not that one, the other stages, you know, are not devotional service. So similarly, one who's actually like Prabhupada, extremely empowered, then he acts so appropriately for every circumstance that people can't even imagine what he's doing. They can't even figure it out all the time. You know, how he's attracting people to become Krishna conscious. But he's just, you know, completely flowing from one situation to another, just acting, you know, completely appropriately and fully empowered to attract people to Krishna. So in that state, then you can't criticize the devotee. Everything is just, you know, is completely in harmony with Krishna's desire. And the other stages, you know, that then he's, there's no question that he's perfectly doing his responsibility. Although he won't think like that. As soon as we start thinking, well, I'm perfectly doing my responsibility, then then we're finished. So even Radharani doesn't think like that. Srimati Radharani, she thinks, I'm just a neophyte, I'm just trying to become a devotee. So that's the thing, I think that's the main responsibility. Just to have the right, to preach the right way and to act the right way. Because that's a big thing. It's not so easy to exactly act the right way. Nor is it so easy really to preach the right way. But one can try and do it. But you know, there may be some discrepancy. And therefore one has to always try and improve. And if one thinks everything is perfect, then one won't try and improve. And then instead of improving, one will decrease. So no one in the spiritual world thinks they're perfect. Even Krishna has this mood that I need the association of my devotees to purify myself. So we may think that this is, you know, oh come on Krishna, you know, you're everywhere, you're aware of everything. But Krishna wouldn't be very happy unless he had that mood. Is that right? Yes.
Not sure. At the time of death, the mind will be disturbed because the senses are disturbed. So my question is, how differently does one in sadhana bhakti who has attained the stage of nistha, imbhava bhakti and or prema bhakti, experience death? How do they experience death?
They don't experience death. Oh, sadhana bhakti? Well, it depends. There's so many levels of sadhana bhakti. But at the stage, higher stages, then of course, especially when you get to a sakti, when the mind is completely fixed on Krishna, then there's no, the death experience is quite minimal. Because practically one doesn't experience the material world very much. And in Bhava Bhakti, every material existence is just a dream. A shadow, actually, it says. So as much as you experience a shadow, that's how once you experience death. And in Prema Bhakti, there is no, you don't have a body anymore. You don't have a material body. Your body is completely spiritual. So Everything is spiritual, as a matter of fact. So there's, you know, you're not even aware when your body passes the elements.
In human Bhagavatam, there's an experience of Narada Muni, when he gets the spiritual body, but it's kind of like a flash.
Lightning and illumination occurring at the same time. Well, it means that there's no, you know, was it? When you see lightning and illumination, they're both simultaneous. So simultaneously leaving his body, he got a spiritual.
This means that Narada Muni was at least at the stage of
Ashakti. Oh no, he was at the stage of Prema. He practiced his whole life from the Bhava platform. I mean, it says, it describes that even when he was with the sages, then taste for the whole, it's taste for Krishna consciousness awakened with him. Madhura Kandambini, especially that life of Narada Muni, is used a lot to describe the different stages. So he was at the, he came to the stage of Prema. Yes. Not necessarily.
Because I heard that if we would be completely without karma, then we don't have to stay in the world, material world anymore.
That's right. But it says even parabdha karma is eradicated. All the four stages, all the different stages, even parabdha. That means we become spiritualized.
But then
for the we have to understand there's a difference between what your body goes through and what the soul goes through. That if one becomes fully Krishna conscious, or at least the stage where you're not aware of your material body anymore, then you're just being an instrument for Krishna. And Krishna has taken over your body. Apparently there's parabdha karma, you're living out your life, but you're not part of the material world anymore. Your body becomes just like a dream.
This is, I suppose, a very high stage.
Yeah, oh, sure. Very high stage.
So I'm thinking about the lower stages, and we still
Oh yeah, of course. That's why we're supposed to keep our health, and because generally speaking, if we don't have good health, you know, parabdha karma. If our parabdha karma, then we can't concentrate on devotional service. We can't imitate. Not that because, you know, I'm chanting my rounds every day, I have no more parabdha karma. Well, you know, if you step on a nail, you have no parabdha karma, and you go right through the ceiling, then you can probably understand I still have a few parabdha karmas on. Not so easy. I mean, the thing is that generally we hear a description and we think that's me. You know, I'm on that stage because, you know, I'm performing devotional service. Of course, we are performing devotional service. It probably gives the example of the green mango and the ripe mango. They're both mangoes. Because one is very sweet and the other one's, you know, has ways to go. So devotional service performed at Sadhana Bhakti, you know, there's a big range, especially in Sadhana Bhakti, there's a huge range between Shraddha all the way up to Asakti. Sometimes
that
like
that.
Well, first of all, we shouldn't assume that even, you know, it takes a very high level for bija and kutam and upper of the karma to be destroyed also. And we completely, they're gradually eradicated as we perform devotional service. I mean, if we can get rid of the avidya or the bija, but to speak of parabdha karma, we'll be doing quite well. So, actually, a little gradually is destroyed at a time. As I said, we can understand when our heart is becoming purified because, you know, we become blissful. There's the taste of bliss. Ladini Shakti means transcendental happiness, which serves the point of Chit Shakti, which is not only happiness, but it's also awareness, samvit. So we become enlightened and we become enlivened simultaneously. And that means a little bit at a time over all the four stages being eradicated. Yes. Are there people on the highest stage?
Yeah.
Maybe. But from our platform, at least we can see there's devotees following. Generally, everyone's looking for the highest stage right away. We can't even see the stage that is right before us. And we want to, just like, if you want to find someone who's, you know, learning, then if you go to a college, you know, you meet people who are, you know, professors and things like that. You don't generally have to find someone who's learned. You don't have to find, you know, Albert Einstein to find someone who's learned. People who have more knowledge than we have, we can take as quite learned. If we only accept a person like Albert Einstein as learned, and looking for another Albert Einstein, we may have a long time before we find one. So generally speaking, although we're very enthusiastic to find the highest stage devotees, but even then, what they'll do is teach us how to appreciate the other devotees. So generally speaking, the most auspicious devotees we can come in contact with are the devotees who can train us up how to perform devotional service and appreciate the other devotees, how they're performing devotional service. And if we overlook those devotees, then even we find the highest, so-called highest devotee, if he's not doing the same thing, or she's not doing the same thing, then they're really not the highest devotee. So if we can find such devotees, appreciate the other devotees, then we're doing quite well. Does that make sense? Anyhow, you can look around for the highest devotees. Yeah, you can say that. But then you have to learn what the highest devotee is. You can say that, but generally to actually understand what the highest devotee is, you'd have to become the highest devotee. It takes one to know one. But from your experience or your appreciation, it's good to think that a devotee is quite elevated. You can appreciate, because you can appreciate their good qualities that they're manifesting. So that's very auspicious. Yeah, well, that's good. So then you can especially perceive everyone as appreciating it. But that doesn't in itself mean that the person's guaranteed to be the highest devotee. You have to come to the highest platform, and then you can understand who's the highest devotee. At least you have to come to the second class platform. Then you'll be able to discriminate better. But in any case, even if one is not on the highest platform, then if one appreciates another devotee and their service, then you'll come to the highest platform. Even that devotee is not on the highest platform, but if you appreciate them, then you'll come to the highest platform. Anyhow, you will gradually learn these things. Anything else? Yes.
I had a discussion with one devotee in regard to the pure devotees' way of describing themselves as very fallen. So this devotee was expressing his understanding that they actually do that because of fear. They don't want to become proud, and thus cause their own fall down. Is that correct understanding of the mood of the pure devotees?
No, it actually feels like that. The Prabhupada said, it's not some intellectual exercise. They actually feel like they're most fallen.
even though they have all this knowledge of the different stages of devotional service. And
oh, they know everything. They know Krishna directly. But consider how big Krishna is and how small we are. So one actually knows Krishna, it's quite a humbling experience. No matter how big we think we are, how insignificant we are compared to Krishna. And then if one considers how much one is in debt to all the other devotees, also many other living entities for so many births, that helped one come to that stage. And if one considers one is completely dependent on Krishna, that it's all by the mercy of Krishna and his guru that he came to that stage, then what is there to be proud of? It's not something artificial.
So it's a completely natural state, and it's not that they impose it on themselves in order to teach others.
No, it wouldn't be very comfortable. It wouldn't be very satisfying. No, it's completely natural. They actually feel like that. Prabhupada emphasized that many times.
But isn't that the kind of negative, like depressing feeling, or is that?
No, it's the highest ecstasy. If you feel like that, you actually feel like that. In Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the whole Panchatattva, all Krishna himself is personally just showering with transcendental bliss. No problem. There's no, you know, it's not like in the material world, everyone hates me, you know, everyone's kicking me around. I feel bad. It's the exact opposite. It's based upon complete appreciation of everyone else, how wonderful they are. Here, we feel bad because we're envious of everyone else. We can't be better than everyone else. And there, it's a complete appreciation of how wonderful everyone else is. And there's no reservation. Because one sees everyone else's is an expansion of the most wonderful person and a complete instrument for the most wonderful person. That's completely natural. One has unlimited appreciation for everyone and everything. The only one one doesn't appreciate is oneself. So it's called true selflessness. But it's not based upon just feeling bad about oneself. It's based upon unlimited appreciation for everyone else.
Yes, because otherwise one can say that this is the opposite side of the false ego, one feeling completely.
No, that's Brahman understanding. You know, that's just negation. But this is just complete appreciation. And even one appreciates oneself, because one knows one is Krishna's servant. But that's all one thinks oneself to be. Therefore, one is, you know, only does things to please Krishna, even with oneself. It says the gopis, they decorate themselves just to please Krishna. So it's not that they neglect themselves, but they know because it's pleasing to Krishna, I'll do it. Therefore, they take care of even themselves to please Krishna. Inconceivable. One more, yes.
Maharaj, I'd like to know, you may say, Brahman.
Actual Brahman? The devotee doesn't. He gets, simultaneously, he gets Brahman and Paramatman and Krishna all simultaneously. But generally, Nishta is the stage of self-realization. Then one is actually fixed in Brahman, in the conception that I'm not this body. But the devotee doesn't walk around in Brahman. He's always in every stage from the beginning to the end. The focus is always on Krishna. So Brahman realization is always there, so, along with Paramatma and Krishna. But one actually realizes the difference. One is actually fixed in the realization of the difference between oneself and the body at the stage of Nishta. But it's only really at the stage of Bhava that one actually understands who one is. So I may know who I'm not, but to find out who I am, it takes some time, some more advancement.
Thank you very much. Grant Rashi, Nectar of Devotion, Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai. Or Premanandaji.